Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Although the Titanic sank nearly a century ago, the tragically ironic story of the unsinkable ship that went down on its maiden voyage remains familiar and fascinating to Titaniacs all over the world. Amid dozens of rumors and myths and conspiracy theories, one question consistently rises to the top. Why did the Titanic sink so quickly? Just over 2.5 hours after striking an iceberg in the North Atlantic, Titanic was completely underwater. In an era when ships in similar crises often managed to limp to safety or at least remain afloat long enough for help to arrive. So what went wrong? And did the ship's crew deserve the blame for the deaths of more than 1,500 people? Brad Mattson explores those nagging questions and their disturbing answers in his new book, Titanic's Last Secrets, The Further Adventures of Shadow Divers John Chatterton and Richie Kohler. Brad, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
We should start with this. How did the speed with which the ship went down play into the number of people who died?
Well, Carpathia, the closest rescue ship, was about an hour and 45 minutes from reaching the scene. So if Titanic had stayed afloat for just that much longer, it would have been a rescue operation instead of a disaster.
And at what point did those who stayed aboard really understand how much trouble they were in?
Well, one of the things that we learned was that the ship broke up at a very low angle on the surface. It did not rise up into the air as in I love James Cameron's movie, but that's great inaccuracy in it. The ship did not rise up and break in half. It broke in half and then sank. And the people were probably caught very unawares when that happened.
Yeah, we're going to talk in a minute about John Chatterton and Richie Kohler, but first maybe you can talk a little bit about the generally accepted theories, like the fact that the ship went up at a big angle and then sank, before this latest trip to explore the wreckage.
Well, generally accepted theories are kind of what really are the soul of evolutionary history. history is written by the powerful, essentially. It's written by the victors. It's often written with pragmatic hidden agendas, and that certainly was the case with the first point of evolution in this story of Titanic, which occurred after the government inquiries, which were held in the United States, conducted by a very interesting fellow named Senator William Alden Smith of Michigan. They started 3 days after Carpathia reached New York, and a month and a half later, another hearing was held. Many months of hearings were held in England, conducted by the British Admiralty. At those hearings, they determined that only Captain Smith was to blame. He was running too fast through a field of ice, that the sinking was an act of God, and that the ship went down certainly in one piece because it was far strong enough to have sustained the iceberg gash and not broken up on the surface. Well, in 1980, that's the story, that's the official story, until 1985, when Dr. Robert Ballard, the great oceanographer from Woods Hole, using Alvin, found Titanic on the bottom after an incredibly long search, and discovered that it was in two widely separated large pieces. The final chapter in our evolution and understanding of what happened to the ship came in 2005 when John Chatterton and Richie Kohler, on an adventure that was either extremely brave or extremely foolhardy, chartered the research vessel Keldysh and its two mere submersibles and went to look for additional pieces of the ship.
Yeah, Chatterton got this phone call from an acquaintance who was going on and on about something that he had seen when he'd gone under just to look at the wreckage.
Yeah, this fellow had gone, interesting guy. He had gone with a number of expeditions and had made submarine dives to Titanic. And in 2000, he made a dive, the last dive of the expedition, and he described to Chatterton coming across a huge field of shoes and debris from trunks. And in front of that, he saw what he called and told Chatterton was ribbons of steel. The theory is that Titanic sideswiped the iceberg, but as everybody who has ever looked at a drawing of an iceberg knows, there are often ice shelves underneath. We know that only one-tenth of the iceberg is on the surface, but beneath the surface, that ice could look like anything. So it's entirely possible that if Titanic grounded on an ice shelf underneath and ripped off pieces of its bottom, it would vastly change the way we think about the sinking and give greater understanding to why it went down so fast. So Chatterton and his partner, Richie Kohler, who were the heroes of a great book called Shadow Divers, mortgaged their houses, pushed a lot of money into the pot, and chartered the ship and went out to take a look.
And neither one of them had ever been in a mere submersible before.
No, it's not for the faint of heart. they're tiny. They hold three people. They're built by Russians, and as one the Russians during a period, they're 25 years old. They've never had an accident with them, and they're wonderful little ships. But a friend of mine who made a dive in one, who is also a naval architect, said when he climbed into it, it was a bad day to be a marine engineer. So it's kind of a scary proposition. The Mirrors, by the way, for those of you who saw Jim Cameron's movie, were the submarines that are in that film.
Let's talk for a minute about why it is so dangerous, theoretically, even though these mirrors have never had an accident. You're really far under, and you can't get back up again for 2.5 hours.
Well, Titanic is at 2.5 miles beneath the surface. It takes about 2.5 hours to get there, 2.5 hours to get back. And if something goes wrong, all kinds of things can go wrong. It's an oxygen-rich atmosphere. You can have a fire. You wear special fire-retardant suits, the same kind of suits that NASCAR drivers wear. There are all sorts of other things that can go wrong, everything from electrical failures. But the worst thing that can happen, of course, is a rupture. There's more than 6,000 pounds of pressure per square inch on every inch of the hull of the Mir, which is a nickel titanium sphere on the inside of this of the housing that you see. What you see when you look at a Mir in the movie is you see the housing around the pressure sphere. Well, if that pressure sphere ruptures, basically a single droplet of water, a micro drop, will enter the sub at the speed of a high-powered rifle bullet, and anyone inside will basically be torn to pieces in a nanosecond.
My guest is Brad Mattson. He's a writer and filmmaker. His new book is called Titanic's Last Secrets, The Further Adventures of Shadow Divers John Chatterton and Richie Kohler. So Kohler and Chatterton decide to take on this great personal risk and certainly financial risk to go down there and look for these ribbons of steel. And we should say that time really is of essence these days in any Titanic exploration because although it was made of metal, much of the ship is biodegrading.
Yeah, in fact, one of the great scientific missions that has been ongoing since Bob Ballard found the ship was to document and measure the exact rate of that deterioration over time, and they've done a pretty good job with it. There's a lot of great data out there about that now. The ship's deteriorating. It's going to be another century or more before it'll be just a brown stain on the bottom. But their problem when they went out was that there was a hurricane on the way, and they were supposed to make four dives. They had two submarines. They were going to dive for four days, and the captain of the ship decided the hurricane was too great a threat, so they were down to three. So they make their first dive to look for the ribbons of steel, and this fellow who told them about it went with John Chatterton in the submarine, and he had the coordinates on the bottom of the location of the ribbons of steel. So they went right to them, and when they got there, sure enough, they found the shoes. They cruise over the shoes. And when they get to what he had called the ribbons of steel, it turned out to be pieces of ducting from the ship. You know, people, you know, like ducting that runs in houses, heat ducting. And it definitely was not pieces of the bottom of the ship. They then that same day sent another submarine back there to look at it to confirm that the ribbons of steel did not exist. Well, they get back on the ship, and of course they want to throw this guy off the side of the ship because Chatterton and Kohler are very much out in the cold, and they have no idea where to go next.
And Chatterton and Kohler, we should mention here, are both brilliant at what they do, both powerful men, but hardly bosom buddies.
No, they're just like any two alphas. You know, if you adopt a couple of alpha dogs from the pound, you got to give them two dishes to eat out of, because if you give them only one dish, it's not going to work out. They're fascinating men. I was introduced to them first when I read the brilliant book Shadow Divers by Rob Kersen. And when I met them, well, I met them on the telephone first, and when they called me, I was in the middle of about happily working halfway through a biography of Jacques Cousteau, which incidentally will come out next summer. I said, look, guys, I've heard that more words have been written about Titanic than anything except Jesus and the Civil War. And the last thing I want to do is jump on the pile. And they said, yeah, but you got to hear our story. And I said, listen, other last thing I want to do is write Son of Shadow Divers. You know, it's such a great book. Then they told me the story, and they got me up to the point where they had failed to find the ribbons of steel. And by that time, I was hooked. I mean, I was ready to go. So
when did things turn for them?
Well, the second day of diving was even worse. They went down, and they were hoping they could find evidence of the grounding on the side of the ship. So they sent two subs down to look at that. They also tried to document some parts of the see if they could document any kind of grounding on the stern, and they saw nothing. They came back. It was a dejected day. The next day, the subs were grounded, I guess they were laid up for maintenance, and it was an agonizing day. They had a meeting, and they were going to try to decide how they best could recoup $350,000 they had pushed into this thing. They were trying to figure out what they could do to save that. Make a film, do something. And at the planning meeting, there was a marvelous technician, a man named Bill Lang. And Bill Lang was with the original crew of Bob Ballard's original crew when they found Titanic in 1985. And he's an electronics technician, really nice guy, quiet, always in the background. He keeps the cameras working, basically, and just loves doing that. Every great picture you've seen from Titanic is probably Bill Lang's. And movie cameras and still cameras. And Bill Lang's hovering on the edge of this desperate planning meeting. And he clears his throat at one point and says, you know, there's this area out to the east of the ship, long way out, 900 meters, that they got some hard targets out there, but nobody's ever really looked at them since the French expedition soon after the discovery, and they didn't make much of it. Why don't you go take a look out there? Or he didn't say that. Then, and of course, Chatterton, it was like throwing him a lifeline, you know, new pieces of the ship that nobody's really analyzed. So they made the decision to go look at that.
And what did they find?
It was an astonishing moment, and I was not in a submarine. I've only seen it on film, but and you can now it's in words in our book. But they found two enormous pieces. Both submarines went to the same place. John and Richie were in one, a film director named Kirk Wolfinger, and a State Department treaty official who was negotiating this Titanic treaty with the Russians and the French and the Canadians was in the other one, and they were separated by about 400 meters. Well, Chatterton and Kohler look out the window. They follow the hard target with the sonar. The pilot of the submarine takes them to it, and they're gliding across an enormous sheet of steel. It's 30 feet wide and 90 feet long. So as soon as they realize what's going on, they try to find one end of it so they can get an accurate perspective on what they're looking at. And they cruise 90 feet, and they can measure this from inside the sub. They cruise 90 feet across this piece of steel, which is precisely the width of Titanic's bottom. So what they found is a 30 by 90 foot piece of steel showing the keel, the bilge keels of Titanic. And just as they're starting to photograph it, the radio crackles, and it's Kirk Wolfinger and the other submarine says, "You're not going to believe what we found." And Chatterton Kohler says, "Yeah, you're not going to believe what we found." And it turns out that Wolfinger and Bob Bloomberg in the other submarine had found an identical piece of steel. And I hear the music, so we'll go back to that, huh?
Go back to this fascinating story in just a minute with Brad Mattson. His new book is called Titanic's Last Secrets, The Further Adventures of Shadow Divers John Chatterton and Richie Kohler. If you want to join the conversation, get on the line now. It's 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. Writer and filmmaker Brad Mattson is my guest this hour. His newest book is called Titanic's Last Secrets, The Further Adventures of Shadow Divers John Chatterton and Richie Kohler. If you want to join us, send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So we have this, we're on the crest of this amazing discovery when we took the break. Let's step back for a minute, though, Brad, because Titanic was famous even before it was launched. But a lot of people might not remember today that it was, in effect, the firstborn of triplets.
Yes, there were three ships designed from the same exact plans drawn up by the architect who is the famous character in the film, Thomas Andrews, who dies. He's the one who says to Rose Dawson, "Rose, I'm sorry I didn't build you a stronger ship." Well, when he designed these three ships, he designed them with specifications that exceeded the required specifications of the British Board of Trade, because he was not sure what an object that big was going to do at sea. He had already built, and he was a designer on the largest ship that Harland and Wolff Shipyard had ever built for the White Star Line, the Oceanic, which was 680 feet long, and he had worked on other larger ships, but nothing in the range of 900 feet, which is where Titanic was. Titanic's first sister, which was launched 9 months and went to sea 9 months ahead of Titanic, was Olympic. When Olympic went to sea during the sea trials, Thomas Andrews was very nervous because he had observed Olympic's hull panting, moving in and out. There's a great deal about this in the book, because we went to Belfast and spent an awful lot of time in the archives at Harland and Wolff and the public records of Northern Ireland, where much of this material is held these days. Anyway, he sees this and then sees Olympic's hull panting, and about 6 months later, before Titanic is even ready to go on the maiden voyage, Olympic gets hit by a British warship in the stern. The propeller wash is so strong that it pulled this warship that was dangerously close into the stern, punched a hole in the stern, so they had to bring Olympic back to Belfast in the dry dock, also the largest dry dock ever built, into dry dock to repair the hole in the hull. Well, when they got it into dry dock, they found out that the steel in the front of the ship was cracking too, and for no good reason. She had just been in normal service. So Harland and Wolff made the decision to immediately begin strengthening the steel on Olympic. And the key difference when Titanic was finally launched and ready to go was that they added a lot of steel on Titanic that's very visible. You can see, if you compare a photograph of Olympic and a photograph of Titanic, you can see that they weren't at all sure how strong these ships had to be, because they watched what happened to Olympic and they added steel to Titanic. Then after the disaster and their internal investigation, which is a whole story in itself, they finished Britannic 2 years later, actually 3 years later, with a full double hull, which was a huge expenditure of steel. The point keeping the amount of steel in a ship to a minimum is because every pound of steel requires more coal to drive it across the ocean, which is the largest expense that a ship owner faces.
And we shouldn't neglect to talk about this. This White Star Line had been purchased by J.P. Morgan for probably more than it was worth.
Yeah, it was a very interesting... when I got into this, I started reading about the builder. His name was William Peary, a very famous man. And the owner of White Star was the son of the White Star Line founder, Bruce Ismay, and everyone will remember him from the movie as the despicable character with the mustache. He just looks evil. He gets in the boat and leaves, and probably shouldn't have done that. And then the third major character in the Wizard of Oz, man behind the curtain scenario, is J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan had started a combine that he hoped to corner a monopoly on the North Atlantic shipping routes, which at the time were selling tickets to about 1.5 to 2 million passengers a year. It was a huge bonanza, and competition was very fierce, mainly with the Cunard line. Cunard had announced plans to send three 900-foot ships to sea and rotating first-class service between New York and Southampton. This was what Bruce Ismay, William Peary, and J.P. Morgan were fighting to defeat. It was a duel to the death. Whoever won was going to dominate. Whoever lost was going to go out of business. Morgan was talked into the deal by William Peary, who also got a deal from Morgan under which all of Morgan's other ships from the other shipping lines he owned would be repaired at Harlan and Wolff as well. Morgan had made all his money in steel, railroads, and land, and as the Wall Street Journal put it after the Titanic disaster, maybe the ocean was just too big for the old man.
So Titanic essentially had this pressure to be bigger, better, faster, more, and so it was kept lighter.
Yeah, faster wasn't so much the issue. They actually made a strategic decision to let Cunard go a few knots faster, and they would sell luxury in all three classes. The best thing about third class on a Titanic, and the Olympic class ships was that there were individual staterooms, and men and women slept at different ends of the ship. Families had their own section, but before that, they were open bays with hammocks and cots. And so it was a very luxurious ship. They wanted to get the immigrant traffic. That's what they were targeting. First class was only window dressing, even though now it gets all the attention.
Brad Mattson is my guest. His book is called Titanic's Last Secrets, The Further Adventures of Shadow Divers John Chatterton and Richie Kohler. Let's take a call now from Rob in Dallas. Hello, Rob.
Hey, how are you today, Chris?
Great, thanks.
Great. I had a quick question for the author. Right after the movie came out and was as successful as it was, there was some speculation or some talk shortly thereafter about the construction of Titanic 2. Does your author know anything about the progress of that, where that project headed, or where it ended? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Rob. Boy, that's a new one on me. Titanic 2, in other words, they were building another version of Titanic. Other than the three original sisters, Olympic, Titanic, and Britannic, I'm not aware that there was a plan there. When they were searching for Titanic, there were many plans to actually raise the ship if they found it. There's a great, and in the book there's a brief treatment of this, but there's a great parade of people who tried to find Titanic and tried to raise it and had all these big plans for it. So,
you mentioned earlier, and this is such a funny thing, that of the limited seats that are available on this mere submersible, there was a legal official there who's going to work on the treaty and everything. Can you talk about, this is no small thing, who owns the wreckage, who claims the wreckage?
Sure, and just to let you and your listeners know, Bob Bloomberg, who unfortunately died before the book came out, he died last year, was a wonderful guy. He was assigned by the State Department. At first, he was a fisheries official negotiating fisheries treaties. And when it became apparent that there, not only the Russian subs, but French submarines could reach the wreck, there was a lot of deterioration. There were people picking things up. The Titanic exhibit, there are two of them that travel around. One of them is, they all claim to be perfectly legal, and I haven't delved into it, so I really can't say whether they are or not. But what Bob Bloomberg and others who were concerned about the wreck were trying to do was to prevent deterioration, and also, not incidentally, Titanic is a tomb. It's a sacred place. And in fact, there's a marvelous moment in, when I was watching the videotape of Bob Bloomberg in his mirror when they first came on the ship, and I hear this kind of muttering over the air, and I finally tune it in, and I hear Bobby's reciting Kaddish, the dead. So, you know, there are a lot of aspects of Titanic that have to do with our fascination with the ship, but we should never forget that 1,500 people died there.
So after they found this portion of the bottom of the ship, and they took measurements and sort of had some ideas, they decided that they also had to really go look at Britannic.
Well, there's something that happened in between, Chris, if I may hang on there just a little bit.
Sure.
John and Richie had no idea what they were looking at other than the fact that it was the bottom of the ship, the two big pieces of the double bottom. Titanic had a double bottom, not a double hull. In other words, there were two pieces of steel separated by about 5 feet in an area that was called the tank. And the tank, they put water in there, ballast water, and it was a big space between the two pieces of the hull. Well, they found these were two full sections of the double bottom. They photographed every inch of them, especially the edges where you could see what happened to the steel. And then they took it to a naval architect who specialized in marine forensics named Roger Long. He lives on the coast of Maine, designs research vessels, just got a new one out, but he's fascinated, has been fascinated with trying to figure out what happened during the the last moments of a ship sinking.
Let me stop you for a second. When you say marine forensics, basically his job is to figure out what happens when a ship goes down. He's
exactly.
a crash investigator.
It's CSI shipwreck is what it is. And so they went to Roger, and Roger looked at the videotape, called him and said, I can't make heads or tails of this. Can we get some drawings of certain pieces of it? So they hired the great Titanic artist Ken Marshall, who also participated in the design of the Cameron movie. And all the great drawings of Titanic are Marshall's. And he sent back two incredible drawings of the bottom, archival architectural drawings showing what the steel was doing on either end. From that, Roger was able to, the patterns in the steel, the wrinkles, how it was wrinkled. From that, Roger was able to deduce that the ship first made an inverted V. Then, if you can follow, the edges of the steel are bending. So the top of the double bottom is compressing, and the tension and the bottom of the ship, the other bottom, the bottom double bottom, is expanding, and then it went back the other way, and it flexed like that several times. Roger hypothesized then that what happened was, as the front of the ship was flooding, and this is the thing that nobody ever really counted on, the middle of the ship was flooding too. And that went a long way to explaining what happened to the ship. I don't want to go too far with some of this because I'm getting into an area that's going to kind of give the book away here, and I want your readers to enjoy the mystery as I did. But Roger discovered, and this is where the low-angle theory of the breakup comes from, is realizing what happened to the middle of the ship that he was able to theorize from the plates that we found on the bottom.
And this, again, was something that no one had ever really considered before.
No one had ever really considered. Again, to go back, just real quick summary. First, the theory was that the official word with the history, as it were, was the ship sank in one piece. The next was that it sank in two pieces. Nobody ever figured that the middle of the ship played a role in the sinking.
There were some lawsuits after the Titanic went down, but they were largely dismissed and settled for much less than what was filed.
Yeah, they settled. I don't have the book right in front of me here, but they settled for, I think, around $665,000 worth of damage claims, which would have been hundreds of times more had they been convicted of negligence by the official hearings, which was, of course, the exercise in the hearings when they were not exactly forthcoming in what they knew.
So you, and I don't know how far you want to go into not giving the book away, but you were contacted during your research by someone who had evidence that might have made the lawsuits turn out very differently.
Yeah, this fellow was he was an engineer, worked at Harlan & Wolff before. The shipyard doesn't exist anymore. Harlan & Wolff, by the way, just to clarify, is now a real estate development company on the waterfront in Belfast. That's primarily what they're doing. They still repair ships, but they don't build any new ones. They had a little bit of a boom during the oil rig days, and they ran at a loss under subsidy of the British government until they were finally off unloaded to a Swedish shipping magnate in the late 80s. Anyway, this fellow we found, or he got in touch with us. He started sending emails. Once John and Richie and Roger Long, the architect, revealed what they knew at a conference in Woods Hole, Massachusetts in the summer of 2005, it made news all over the world. Obviously, it was a different story of how the ship sank, and it was very credible. Roger Long got emails from this guy in Belfast, says, you can't possibly know what you know unless you've been sneaking around my office, essentially. And you had seen the documents that I've seen over the years. And that's as far as I want to go, but we received that kind of confirmation. And at that point, that, for us, was the encouragement to probably, we redoubled our efforts. That's when we went to Belfast and realized we had to dig through these archives ourselves.
You talked, Brad, about the standards that the British government had set for shipbuilding. How regulated was the industry at the time?
Well, that's a point that's gotten very interesting and extremely relevant now, because what we're finding out is that the economic collapse that we're enduring, and we haven't seen the beginning of the trickle down of this thing, is because traders who were speculating and betting on aspects of the market were able to create new kinds of securities and investments that were essentially unregulated because the regulations were written years ago. Well, that's exactly what happened to Titanic. According to the Board of Trade regulations, Titanic only needed 16 lifeboats. because it was a ship over 10,000 tons requiring 16 lifeboats. Well, Titanic was a bit over 10,000. It was 55,000 tons. And originally, when Andrews specified the lifeboats, he specified 48. And then the owner said, no, the regulations say we can do this. Let's cut it to 16. It'll give first-class passengers more deck space. Well, this regulatory environment that we're seeing as the culprit in our current situation with the money, with the economy, is very, very similar to what happened with Titanic. And I really do point a finger at those regulators and their hubris and their unwillingness to accept the fact that their greed might be getting in the way of good decisions.
Do you think that it's been unfair to blame the captain of the Titanic all this time?
Absolutely, without a doubt. He's a fascinating character as well. Any author who gets the gift of great characters, remains grateful through the work. But Smith was a fascinating guy. Started at sea in square riggers for the 15 years before Titanic. He was the senior captain at White Star. Made the maiden voyage on every one of their new ships. And he was known as a bit of a hot rodder. He ran a couple of them aground, and he had one collision. And he was so powerful and so favored by the management of White Star that he remained their senior captain. And at the time, he was the highest paid sailor in the history of the world, which is kind of an interesting thought. And Smith probably was going too fast. He probably should have slowed down. Probably should have gone further south. But there's no evidence at all to indicate that Bruce Ismay, who was aboard, the owner of the White Star Line, forced Smith to go too fast.
Brad Mattson is my guest. His new book is called Titanic's Last Secrets, The Further Adventures of Shadow Divers John Chatterton and Richie Kohler. We'll be back to our discussion in a moment. If you've got a question about Titanic, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Brad Mattson. His new book is called Titanic's Last Secrets, The Further Adventures of Shadow Divers John Chatterton and Richie Kohler. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Erwin in Fort Worth. Hi, Erwin.
Hi. I have a question for Mr. Mattson.
Okay.
Hi, Erwin.
Hi. You had mentioned something about the 2.5-hour ascent and descent time to Titanic and that it was an oxygen-rich atmosphere. It was always my understanding that submarines operated with normal oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere. Could you comment any more on that? And I was also wondering if the ascent and descent times had to do with human physiology the same way scuba divers can require a decompression time on ascent.
No, Erwin, they don't. You don't require. You're at one atmosphere the whole time. You're in a mirror, and basically, what's going on there is exactly what happens inside a spacecraft. They're injecting oxygen into the air and scrubbing out the CO2 with soda lime. So it's really just a spacecraft environment, which until these were built before the fire, we're still operating like the spacecraft, the Apollo spacecraft that killed Grissom, White, and Chaffee.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We should talk for a minute, because you have some great accounts in the book of what the survivors witnessed as this ship was going down. There's a stewardess who was working, Violet Jessop. Can you talk a little bit about what the experience was from the time that people started realizing there was a problem to those that got on the lifeboats were there?
Well, Sure. Interestingly enough, I mean, one of the most daunting things about writing this book was writing that scene again. Obviously, everybody is familiar with the sinking of the ship. The scene has been written hundreds of times by great writers, and my knees were shaking every time I sat down to work on that, trying to find some intimate way to portray the events of that horrible moment from perspectives of passengers, crew, and the owners and officers of the ship. So what I did was I went from person to person, and from their notes, there's an enormous amount of material. I'm looking at my bookshelf with probably 50 or 60 Titanic books on the shelf, many, many firsthand accounts for survivors. And the woman you mentioned, Violet Jessop, was a fascinating character. She was either the luckiest or the unluckiest woman ever to sail the sea. She survived not only the Titanic disaster, but she was aboard Britannic when it hit a German mine and sank in 1916, and she survived that too. And it was always my contention that we should get Violet, and she's gone on into eternity now, but we should have got her and taken her to the racetrack, you know. But she was in her stateroom reading, and according to her account in her book, she wrote a terrific little book with an editor she knew, and according to her account, she was in her stateroom reading, being thankful for the electric lights in crew's quarters. And the crew loved Thomas Andrews, too, the designer, because the crew's quarters on Titanic were better than crew's quarters on any other ship that had ever sailed. Anyway, Violet Jessop was in her stateroom reading. Her cabin mate was below her on the lower bunk, and she just felt something change in the motion of the ship. It wasn't much, but when you're at sea all the time, you're really attuned to what this great thing is doing that's keeping you alive. And she felt a shiver of the ship, and she looked over the side to her cabin mate, who was a woman named Elizabeth Leather, and she says, "Well, Elizabeth, I do think something's happened." And Elizabeth says, "Yes, I guess we better go look." And so there are these wonderful accounts, and so I tried to recreate them from the experiences and the credible accounts of witnesses and people aboard the ship.
And then when Ismay sees the ship go down from the safety of his rowboat, if you can call it that, he doesn't want to turn back around. And the next time he does, there's been all this noise and everything. The ship is just gone.
Yeah, Ismay, I drew that material. Incidentally, for readers who I hope care about this kind of thing in writing accurate history, the book has 25 pages of endnotes which explain all of these resources and references that we used, or I used, in creating the accounts of things like Bruce Ismay in the lifeboat and then Bruce Ismay climbing up the ladder onto Carpathia. All that was taken from his direct testimonies given under oath to the Senate this United States Senate inquiry that was held, that it began 3 days after Carpathia got to New York. But yeah, Bruce Ismay was in the lifeboat. He was one of the last men off the ship. And of course, when he walked into the hearing room, people turned their backs on him. It was a disgrace for him to have survived.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Brad Mattson is my guest. The new book is called Titanic's Last Secrets. Let's speak next to Rollins in Dallas. Hey, Rollins.
Hey. Well, first of all, thank you so much for this one, because I'm telling you, I'm obsessed with Titanic. I've read everything I ever could about it. In fact, I'm planning right now to go to Halifax, Nova Scotia, because there are three major cemeteries there, you know, that housed the people that were found frozen in the water and so forth and so on. So I'm dying to read your book. My question is this. Very quickly, could you tell me, as someone who really feels a great desire to show my respects to those who died on the Titanic, could you tell me any other places you felt that would be significant places, such as Halifax, where I could go to further get a sense of that? Does that make any sense?
Absolutely, and I'm almost afraid to answer your question, because you better get your checkbook out.
Well, believe me.
There are some wonderful
fees afar. I mean, money is just water these days. Isn't that what they say?
Well, there are some wonderful places you can go, and I mean wonderful in the sense that there are monuments to Titanic in Australia. There is an incredible monument to Titanic And if you go to Belfast, there are murals on the walls that used to be political murals during the time of Troubles. There are monuments to the dead. There's William Peary's grave and his wife's grave. His wife is a very important character in the story, too, Lady Peary. There is a wonderful monument to the dead members of Titanic's band near Southampton, and also a marvelous memorial to the engineers. All of the engineers on Titanic died, every last one of them. There were 29. And they died because they stayed aboard downstairs in the depths of the ship to keep the lights on till the very last minute. But there are many places to go and great libraries. I'll go on just one more minute here.
Sure.
The British National Archive in London is an incredible resource, and you can get at all this. And the Public Records of Northern Ireland in Belfast is another place. There's also the Ulster Folk and Transport Museum, which has a great Titanic exhibit.
You were talking about the engineers heroically keeping the lights on. Were there any other technological solutions that might have been undertaken that would have kept the ship afloat longer?
Well, that's a great question, because one of the things that we were puzzled by, and actually I was never able to get to the heart of it, was why the pumps didn't do more. We actually think it might be, that's Roger Long and I, the naval architect, the forensics guy. We think that it was very possible that as the passengers declined to get in the first six lifeboats, which were launched less than half empty, all the rest of the crew had no idea that the ship was going to sink. And I believe that the engineers didn't think it was going to sink until the bottom went out of the middle of the ship. And I don't think that the rest of the crew felt that way either. I think that they all thought it was going to stay afloat.
And in fact, based on recent history, within weeks before the Titanic sunk, there were ships that had problems and didn't sink.
Oh, yeah. Shipwreck. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds, thousands of ships at sea, just like you see those maps now of airplanes in the sky with the red dots showing every airplane in the sky that are so astonishing. Well, the sea was full of ships then. There were wrecks all the time. But one of earlier Harland and Wolff ship, the Republic, was struck right in the middle by another liner, the Florida, a different shipping company, off the coast of Nantucket, and it was holed in almost the same way that Titanic was, and it stayed afloat for 38 hours. Everybody got off.
So people at that point on Titanic might have thought it was more dangerous to be lowered down, dozens of feet into the water that was freezing cold. Yeah.
Absolutely, unquestionably. I mean, it's a choice that a sane person would make.
What do you think, Brad, is the reason that we continue to ponder this question? I mean, obviously there are always a small subset of people that really become obsessed with tragedies like these, but this is one of those that nobody really lets go of.
Well, a lot of the myth and the theories and the fascination, passion, obsession with Titanic was really built around the fact that it was a tragedy that cut across social classes and that the ship itself was a heroic object. I was very aware of this as I was writing this book. The title is, and I admit, slightly hyperbolic. Somebody's going to find out something else about Titanic in the future, I have no doubt. But as I went through, we found out an awful lot that clarifies the picture of what happened during the final minutes of the ship. But what troubled me as I worked on it was that Titanic was diminished in my mind from a heroic object to just another piece of corporate greed and hubris. That here was a bunch of people trying to make money. They weren't trying to do the world any favors. And as I got to know these people better, they weren't evil. But they were real hardcore business people that were trying to make money. That was their whole program. And I'm not indicting people who try to make money, believe me. I mean, that's what we do. But the thing is that the image of Titanic as a heroic ship, the ship of dreams, has been kind of watered down. And I'm afraid that people who read this book are going to find that's the case.
Is that the moral of the story for you?
The moral of the story for me is really that that human beings make mistakes for a lot of very complicated reasons, and that if you're trying to understand history, you absolutely have to wrestle and grapple with the complexity.
Do you know whether anyone else has ever claimed that a ship was unsinkable? It seems like the worst possible, it's like telling an actor good luck before he walks out on stage, the worst possible thing you'd think.
Yeah, and that, actually there were quite a few news reports in which Titanic was referred to as unsinkable, although the company was very careful. They never said anything like that. Captain Smith, however, did in an interview that I found with the shipping newspaper in London. But, yeah, the Great Eastern was a very interesting example of that. It was a huge ship. The Great Eastern was a paddle-wheel steamer, and it was, in fact, unsinkable. It had water. The deal with watertight compartments is that you put a bulkhead in that can close the door, so you're basically building. Titanic had 17 watertight compartments, which is like 17 separate ships. The problem with Titanic was that in order to ease passage in the passenger decks, the watertight bulkheads didn't go all the way to the top. That was the problem. That was a very good point that Jim Cameron made in his movie, how the water flowed over those. Although we know now that it didn't take the water flowing over those to sink the ship because the middle of the ship let go.
So it wasn't just a matter of those compartments failing.
Right, and on the Great Eastern, though, they went all the way to the top deck. It made it very hard to get around the ship. But when the Great Eastern hit a rock off Long Island, it steamed into New York under its own power.
Of the extraordinary images that Lang has captured and that we've seen, especially after this last dive that Chatterton and Kohler made, is there one that really sticks in your head, a particular picture?
Well, for anyone who's seen it, that shot of the bow still is just absolutely mesmerizing to me. It's, of course, the shot that in the great film, it's the metamorphosis moment when they transform the ship from this wreck on the bottom into the ship at the dock right before it sails. It's a great moment. That was phenomenal. Another really amazing one to me was the shot of the propeller at the stern of the ship. That was overwhelming.
Did you have moments of sort of phobia about getting on a watercraft when you were working on this project?
No, but I'll tell you a funny story. When my grandson, Milo, was 3 years old when I started working on this book 3 years ago, and he didn't quite grasp that I wasn't going to go on the Titanic, but that when he heard that Titanic hit an iceberg and sank, he really obsessed with it. He was terribly frightened for me. We have a deep connection. And it was the same as when Diesel 10 attacked Thomas the Tank Engine in the Thomas the Tank Engine cartoons on the television. Milo would reenact that moment over and over. So he got in very much into reenacting the moment of Titanic hitting the iceberg as a way of visualizing it for himself. So his Bobby, that's what he calls me, Bobby. So his Bobby wasn't going to go on the Titanic.
So the next generation of Titaniacs is born.
Yeah, still loves it.
Brad Mattson, a fascinating book. It's called Titanic's Last Secrets, The Further Adventures of Shadow Divers, John Chatterton and Richie Kohler. What a great piece of storytelling, Brad. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a great interview. I really appreciate it, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.